Welcome back to Question Medicine. This is Andrew Bill, and I am down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. It is good to be back. The weather is starting to heat up. The spring breakers are leaving the beach, and it is such a great time to be in Florida. But with every great time to live in Florida comes another great podcast straight out of Florida. So without further ado, it's good to be back. Cue the music. All right, podcast listeners, let's kick it off with what I'm talking about, with what I'm reading about, with what I'm thinking about. Let's do this. And the first article goes back. It takes me way back. It takes me back to the days when Joe and I were recording, and we were talking about bisphosphate therapy or DEXA scans and what should we do with it. And we sort of got into the treatment, but not much. But what we kind of said was, listen, test once, test only once. Don't test again. Start him on the medication. And when you looked at the evidence, it appeared that treating for over 5 years, 5 to 7 years, probably wasn't beneficial, or at least wasn't really documented in the literature as being beneficial. Well, now you have it. That is right. We have now a study in the Journal of American Geriatric Society back in 2017, September, titled Long-Term Oral Bisphosphate Therapy in Fractures in Older Women, The Women's Health Initiative. The Women's Health Initiative is, I think, where we've gotten almost all of our evidence on DEXA scans and estrogen use and all that. So anyways, what did they show? What did they find? They pretty much looked at over 5,000 women who had a 5-year hip fracture risk of equal to or greater than 1.5%. And then over 2 years, so you had to have at least 2 years of bisphosphonate therapy. And then they looked at what was your fracture risk? How often were you getting fractures? What was going on? And they broke it down into, were you on therapy for 2 years, 3 to 5 years, 6 to 9 years, and 10 to 13 years? And we would think that more would be better, right? You're on this protective or quote-unquote protective drug to protect you from fractures. Longer would be better. But it appears that those that were on therapy for 10 to 13 years, when you compare 10 to 13 years of therapy to just the 2 years of therapy, when you were on longer, so 10 to 13 years of therapy, you had an increased risk of fracture. Hazard ratios 1.29 for any clinical fracture, 1.66 for hip fractures, 1.65 for vertebral fractures. So what do you make of all this? I mean, longer is better. I think there's two things we can make of it. I still think once you do a DEXA scan, don't do another one anytime soon, because the test isn't accurate enough to know whether there's actually a change going on. The really only way to tell is to run the test 700 times, average them, and then that's probably the realistic number. Number two is, with this new evidence that longer is not necessarily better, and the medications at best aren't that great, we probably should not be treating osteopenia, just osteoporosis. And if you're one of those people that says, but I love to treat osteopenia, I love to treat the surrogate marker of the disease for the disease. If you're one of the people that says, I like to treat pre-diabetes before it becomes diabetes, well, that's fine, but you're not doing your patient any benefit. You're not doing your patient, you're actually doing your patient harm. Because we know now that longer treatment's not necessarily beneficial. In fact, looking at this, it's probably harmful. And you're costing them money. They're having to take a drug. There's a lot of things that go with this. Osteopenia, when is the right time? Maybe 5 years-ish. Stop them. When do you restart them? I don't know. We don't have that information yet. But give them a drug holiday of a year, 2 years. I'm completely making those numbers up. And then restart them and see how they do. But they definitely will not benefit from continuous bisphosphonate therapy. The next article falls under the category of rare things that you may never see but should probably be on your radar, or at least maybe you'll see them a lot more now if they're actually on your radar, because you can't diagnose what you don't know. This was a paper titled Clinical Manifestations and Outcomes of Fluoroquinolone-Related Acute Interstitial Nephritis. This is in Mayo Clinical Proceedings, January 2018. And basically, here's what they found. They looked at 24 cases. I know it's only 24 cases, and it's between the years of 1993 through 2016. So, again, one case maybe a year, but it's the use of fluoroquinolones, ciprofloxacin, or levofloxacin, and then acute interstitial nephritis. The average duration was 7 days. The mean baseline creatinine was 1, but then it peaked up to almost 7 with these acute interstitial nephritis episodes. So you have a patient, normal kidney function, and then bam, you're dropping them into acute kidney injury or renal failure. Maybe it's the fluoroquinolone. And maybe we're thinking in some of these patients, oh, it could be the infection. It could be their blood pressure medication. It could be X, Y, and Z. Or maybe it's the antibiotic. What do you do with this information? I think this just goes to the whole fact that antibiotics are not benign. Giving an antibiotic so you can get out of the room is great to get out of the room, but it is not great for the patient. I know we've all done it. I know that we'll probably all do it again, but we shouldn't do it. And we know we shouldn't do it. And this is just another example of why we shouldn't do it. And speaking of antibiotics and how they shouldn't be given, there is this paper in Chest 2017 back in December that was titled The Burden of Viruses in Pneumonia Associated with Acute Respiratory Failure, an Underappreciated Issue. And here's what this found. This basically looked at, or rather was, an analysis of critically ill patients with pneumonia. I'm talking mechanical ventilation, the sickest of the sick. They're in the ICU, they're on pressors, they are the real deal. And it was about 350 patients, and when they took the swabs and they grew the cultures and they did viral testing, they found that 46% of the patients had bacterial etiology, while 32 had no pathogen, and a whopping 22 yielded viruses. That's 1 in 5 people in the ICU on mechanical ventilation. We're talking high Apache 2 score, septic shock, increased hospital mortality, all because of viruses. When this happens, what should we do? I mean, I think the way we can maybe apply this, and there needs to be more research on this, is if it's a virus and we think it's a virus, we should probably stop the antibiotics. Again, antibiotics are not benign. And if we're giving these really sick patients antibiotics, how do we know that we're not killing off the quote-unquote good bacteria that is helping the patient live or helping try to fight off the viruses and help the body build? And how do we know? We don't know until we do it. And how do we know we're not giving them C. diff? Well, I mean, we know we are giving them C. diff, but we think the risk of giving them C. diff is worth it if we're saving their life from a bacterial infection. But if it's not bacterial, then we're just putting them at risk of C. diff. There's a lot of things I think go in this, and I think this should lead the way for further studies of, is it a virus? Stop the antibiotic, and then continue the antibiotic in some and see what happens. If that comes out, I will certainly let you know if I hear about it. And next up, we need to ring the alarm. We need to ring the alarm because there are new guidelines out. Yo, yes, new guidelines out that will change board questions forever. Board questions that we all know and love so well. The board question goes something like this. You have a 35-year-old male comes into the clinic. He is having sore throat or cellulitis or whatever this question stem may be, and you decide to give him clindamycin. Roughly 7 to 10 days later, he is experiencing 5 episodes of watery diarrhea every single day. You come in, you do PCR, you confirm it's C. diff. What is the next best step in the management of this patient? And even my mother knows that the next best step in the management of this patient has got to be Flagyl, or at least for the boards. And that is until now, when we have new C. diff guidelines out. So let me give you some highlights for them all. First of all, only patients with risk factors for C. diff and greater than 3 unformed stools in a 24-hour period should be tested. That's super important. 3 or more stools. If they come in and say, listen, I had 2 episodes of diarrhea, meh, you don't count. Only 3 or more. Again, we know antibiotics are the biggest cause of C. diff, and these guidelines specifically talk about how every hospital should have we should think about enrolling an antimicrobial stewardship program, meaning don't give out antibiotics and reduce antibiotics or change antibiotics or de-escalate antibiotic therapy as soon as possible to try to prevent C. diff. As I said before, Flagyl was the first go-to therapy. We knew it was fragile. It was fragile for adults and children. It is now only first line for children. So if you take care of adults, fragile is no longer the number one numero uno option. Number one is now vancomycin and fidaxomicin, or Difacid. So those are your two options now. But here are some problems, or at least some problems that I think, is that vancomycin and fidaxomicin are both pretty expensive. I mean, we're talking, if you're in cash pay for this, we're looking at about $1,000 for a treatment course, or up to $4,500. That's a lot of money that most patients can't afford. So realistically, if they don't have insurance, insurance isn't going to cover it, which they should soon, then we're looking still at using Flagyl because it's significantly cheaper. Additionally, the new guidelines talk about anti-motility agents. I'm talking about loperamide, or aka Imodium. And previously, what we kind of always thought were anti-motility agents were bad because they would block you up and you want to get rid of the C. diff. You want to poop it all out. You want to get rid of it. It's going to be terrible. But then we had a published review article where they looked at the literature to determine the basis of this practice. Well, I mean, was this based on the good old gobsat, the good old boys sitting around the table saying, I think that we shouldn't give Imodium because that'll block it up? Or was it based on hard evidence? And here's what they found, that all patients who experienced complications or died and were given anti-motility agents alone initially were not given anti-C. diff therapy, meaning they weren't given antibiotics. They were just given, here's some Imodium and be on your way. They weren't given treatment. And I can tell you, whether you get Imodium or not, and you're not given the treatment for C. diff, you will die. You will absolutely die for sure, 100%, if you are not treated for C. diff. It may be from dehydration. It may be from hypokalemia or some sort of electrolyte balance, but you will die. So this says, listen, the authors of this new guideline, they're saying it's probably safe to give anti-motility agents to patients, but they also need to be getting anti-C. diff therapy. Boom, there you go. There you have it. And that leads me to the last step. The last set of guidelines I'm going to talk about real fast, and it actually deserves a round of applause. I saved the best for last, if you will, because these are the stroke guidelines. The new stroke guidelines out this year. And you all know that one of the things that I hate about guidelines is that it's always too little too late. I mean, by the time the guidelines actually get together and come out, there's new research, there's new evidence. And if it's kind of like that old saying that if you're reading textbooks, then you're a little bit, you know, out of the realm of what's important. Same thing. If you're reading guidelines, you're out of the realm of what's clinically important because new research is already published. Until these guidelines, and these guidelines that I'm talking about are the stroke guidelines. That's right, baby. The stroke guidelines, published January 24th in the Journal of Stroke. This was released at the International Stroke Conference and roughly at the exact same time that the DEFUSE 3 trial was released. The DEFUSE 3 trial is one of the trials that actually changes or makes these guidelines possible. So the simple fact that the paper that is making these guidelines possible, or one of the papers that making these guidelines possible, is released in the New England Journal of Medicine on basically the exact same hour that the stroke guidelines are being released, that's up-to-date medicine, and they deserve a round of applause. Basically, here's what you need to know. According to the updated guidelines, patients should be considered for thrombectomy in under 6 hours after a stroke onset if they meet the criteria. And the criteria is a modified Rankin scale of 0 to 1, a causative occlusion of the internal carotid artery or middle cerebral artery, age over 18, a NIH stroke scale score of 6 or greater, and an Alberta stroke program early CT score of 6 or greater. Again, you may not have to worry about that. Talk with your radiologist, but talk with your neurologist. But get these out there because we're now thinking thrombectomy. Thrombectomy is where it's at. That's what these guidelines are talking about. And it says even if the patients should receive Alteplase, that doesn't mean that they shouldn't then also receive thrombectomy. And we shouldn't wait for the results of the Alteplase before we go to thrombectomy, and we can give both. We can do both, and we probably should do both. These guidelines also recommend thrombectomy in eligible patients at 6 to 16 hours after a stroke. That's 1A recommendation. That is based on the Diffuse 3 trial and the Dawn trial. And then there's another recommendation in this paper that recommend it's reasonable to consider thrombectomy 6 to 24 hours after a stroke. And that one is a 2A recommendation, where the 6 to 16 is a 1A recommendation. And you might be saying, wait, why is 1 at 1A, 1 is 2A? Well, Dawn and Diffuse 3 looked at patients up to 16 hours, but only the Dawn trial looked at patients from 16 to 24 hours, and you need at least two studies to get that 1A recommendation. So there it is. That's what you have. I think these guidelines and really these papers coming out are in my book ranking as papers of the year already, 2018, because this is it. I mean, these were guideline-changing papers, and previously, at least up to 6 hours, you'd come in and we'd say, sorry, we have nothing for you. And how many patients would we see that would come in, went to bed last night at 8 o'clock, woke up at 5, and I can't speak, or my hand doesn't work. And now we have something to offer them, if they fall in the specific criteria. And I think it's really important that they fall in the criteria. And I'm not going to go through all of the criteria because you're going to have to look them up again. And we should probably all go read the actual papers themselves because the inclusion criteria is so important. In fact, the guidelines even state that MRI perfusion is recommended to aid in patient selection for mechanical thrombectomy. But, huge but there, only when imaging and other eligibility criteria from randomized controlled trials showing benefit are being strictly applied in selecting patients for mechanical thrombectomy. Meaning, if you didn't meet the inclusion criteria, you probably shouldn't go to mechanical thrombectomy. We know that this is really good, 6 to 24 hours, or at least probably the best we have, 6 to 24 hours so far. It's the only thing we got, 6 to 24 hours. But only in the patient population that is very strictly picked out, perceived. It's like everything in medicine. When you start going away from the guidelines, when you start treating people that are maybe not as high risk or different inclusion drift, if you will, when you start treating the pre-diabetes instead of the diabetes, when you start treating the osteopenia instead of the osteoporosis, bad things happen because you're treating a different patient population than which was studied. And with that I will leave you now, and I will end this podcast like I have ended every podcast before it. Until next time, keep the quest in questioning.